23, the podcast of the Arts Council of Greater Baton Rouge, where our mission is to foster the creative capacity and vibrancy of the Capital Region through advocacy, resources, and education. Good morning and welcome to AC23. I'm your host, Pam Bortolin, and I've got a very special guest with me today, Dr. Bill Grimes. He not only started the jazz program at the LSU School of Music, but he did an awful lot to bring jazz to our city. Welcome, Bill.
Thank you for having me.
So, first of all, you've got a very special event coming up here at the Cary Sauvage Community Arts Center.
Yeah, it's a very bad one.
I know mine's approaching.
I'm turning 70 years of young, mm-hmm. and I wanted to give myself a present. Mm-hmm. So I called up a friend of mine who's really an amazing musician. I've known him since we were in graduate school. His name is Byron Stripling, and he's the principal pops conductor of the Pittsburgh Symphony. He played Satchmo on Broadway, Louis Armstrong on Broadway. He played with the Count Basie Band. He played with Woody Herman. He played with Lionel Hampton. He's a big star.
Yeah.
I write a lot of music for him, write a lot of arrangements. And so I called him up and said, hey, man, I got a birthday. Could I coerce you to come down and do a party and play? And so he's going to show up next Monday. And Mike Esnault, our colleague, has set up some school visits for him. And we're going to give a concert on March the 27th, which is actually 3 days after my birthday, but that doesn't matter. This is my present to myself and my gift to the Baton Rouge jazz community, because it's been such, as I told you a few minutes ago, this year I will have been in Baton Rouge 40 years.
Wow.
That's the longest I've ever lived anywhere. So it's a gift to myself and to the community. So we're gonna do a concert downstairs at the Arts Council, and it'll be amazing. He's just such a great entertainer and performer.
Okay, I'm looking forward to that one. That's a pretty good birthday present.
Yeah, I think so.
I kind of like that one. So since you've only been here for 40 years, where did Bill come from?
Okay, I'll try to make a long story longer. I grew up in North Carolina, left there in 1972 to go to college as a piano major, of all things.
Okay.
And I went to the Cincinnati Conservatory and met my girlfriend. She's now my wife, has been for almost 45 years. And she was also a piano major. And I was a piano major until I heard her play. I said, this is a bad idea. But I was getting a lot of work as a bass player. So when I was a junior in college, I started working six nights a week in a jazz club with some amazing older musicians who took me under their wing and told me in no uncertain terms what I was doing wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So from there, we got married in 79. We moved to Rochester, New York in 1981 to pursue graduate degrees in jazz studies at the Eastman School. I got to study with Rayburn Wright, the great arranger from Radio City Music Hall. And I got to study with Bill Dobbins, an amazing jazz pianist. We still keep in touch, and he was here 5 years ago for my retirement party from mm-hmm. LSU. And I'm thinking about having him down next year for my 71st birthday.
The first anniversary.
The first anniversary of this birthday party. So I got serious about the jazz idiom when I went to graduate school. I got really serious. And I got serious about jazz education. Answered a job application, submitted an application to LSU in 84. Interviewed, they offered me the job, and we moved down here in August, and we got here, and my wife said, what have we done?
And you stayed.
Well, you know, we said to ourselves, we're not going to stay here. This is a great first job, but it turned out to be a great job, period. I was misinformed as to, you know, I looked at the problems with this LSU School of Music, and I thought they were just awful. And then I got out into the world, and I said, well, every school has problems like this, most of them much worse than LSU. Mm-hmm. We've reared two children here, and in fact, next November, Willis Deloney, my dear friend, and I are going to do a concert in November, which will be the 40th anniversary of us becoming a duo.
Oh, wow.
We played our first concert in November of 1984 in the old Colonnade, if you remember that place.
I do.
So that's basically who I am in a nutshell. You know, I've retired from LSU, but I'll never retire from music.
Okay. So what was it that made you pick up the bass? How did that come into the picture?
This is another long story, which I'll make longer. I was 12 years old. My parents bought me a guitar. My mom was a violinist and a music teacher, so our home was really musical. They bought me a guitar, and I was listening to one day, I had a little stereo in my room, a little turntable, and I was listening to, I shouldn't say this, people will get the wrong idea, but I was only 12. I was listening to Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass.
I loved Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass.
So my mother comes into my room, and I'm playing the bass line on the bottom four strings of the guitar. And she, being a musician, said, well, that's odd. He's not only playing the bass line, he's playing the exact bass line. So they got me a bass, and I got a few lessons, and I started playing in some rock bands with some, you know, some high school kids. And then I guess I just gravitated to it because bass players work a lot compared to piccolo players.
Yeah.
You know, it's a drag to have to carry it around. But everybody, almost everybody, needs a bass player.
Yeah.
So I was really, really fortunate to get to study with some of the people I did. I mean, really blessed to have studied with Frank Brown and Frank Vincent, these two guys in Cincinnati, and Raven Wright and Bill Dobbins at Eastman. So when I was playing with Frank, I was playing bass in a club six nights a week, and Frank was, I don't know, he was probably 12 years older than I, and he knew a bunch of tunes. Mm-hmm. Well, that means I had to learn a bunch of tunes. So now people in today's jazz world say, hey, man, you know that? Yeah, I know that. You don't need to pull your phone out and look at the chord changes on your phone? No.
Been playing in a long time.
Yeah. So... now, there's a lot of music I still don't know, but when it comes to old standards, even going back to music to the 1920s, I learned that as a bass player. I'm also fortunate that because I studied the piano, I've got some piano chops, not great. So I still play that a lot. In fact, I just inherited my mom's piano. We shipped it down here from North Carolina. It's a Steinway, and we've had it tuned, and we're going to have it worked on a little bit. But we have two grand pianos in our living room. Jan and I play duets every day. It's just amazing. It's just fantastic.
Can I come over for coffee?
Sure. we have a couple of pieces we play for friends. It take about 1 minute because most people, that's the limit of their attention span. So we play, and they love it. You know, but we have fun with it. And then my dear friend Mike Esnault comes over every now and then, and we play jazz, two pianos. Mm-hmm. He's really stretching me because he's an amazing musician. So that's how I got into the bass. My ears, people say you have good ears. That's a euphemism for you can process pitch at a pretty high level. So I think that's what led me to being a bass player.
Okay, so where did the love of jazz come from?
Ah, it's a great question. There was a place in my hometown. It was a little jazz club called The Groove. And it was in the back of a bowling alley. It was a little club. People could go in and, you know, get a taste and hear some jazz. So my bass teacher was the bass player in that group. Now, this would have been in the late 1960s, early 70s. And we were playing electric bass. That was the thing back then. And he said, I've got a meeting I have to go to. Could you play for me next weekend? And I thought, oh, man. I'm going to be playing with those guys? I was a sophomore in high school.
Oh, wow.
So I did. And I had been going up there. Sometimes they'd let me go in, even though I was underage, they'd let me go in and just listen.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a place called The Groove in the back of a bowling alley.
I have a vision of what all that entails.
Yeah, it was, you know.
So how did you go from playing jazz to teaching jazz? I mean, what made you say, I don't want to be a professional? I mean, you are a professional musician, but what made you go into the teaching route?
Well, there's a joke out that goes, why did you become a jazz musician? And the answer is, because I really like to be alone. Meaning, it's art music, and it's got a smaller audience share than classical music, which is a pretty small audience share to begin with. So, and I was studying at Eastman with this guy, Rayburn Wright, who was the boss of high-level jazz education. And I didn't think I would like it. And then once I got into it, and I saw that I was having some success, it just took off.
Okay. What is it about getting others hooked on that? Because you've been a great ambassador for jazz in the Baton Rouge community. You've helped nurture that that genre and get people to experience it. So how is it fulfilling to do that?
I think anybody who has great passion for their area, could be dance. It could, my sister was really into dance and drama. I'm really into music. Other people are really into poetry. If you've got that passion, you really can't hide it from people. So I just enjoy, you know, I enjoy connecting with an audience. And that's one of the things that people will see should they come to this Byron Stripling concert. He knows how to connect with an audience in an amazing way.
Okay. So you wrote 20, you're not just a jazz guy. You've got the credentials elsewhere. You wrote 23 scores for the Beach Boys in 9 weeks. If my memory serves me correct, did you conduct them when they were here with the symphony?
Yeah, it was supposed to be at Hemingbell,
and it
got rained out. And so they rescheduled it later in the fall, and they did it at the PMAC. And the Beach Boys were scared. They'd never done this.
Yeah.
They didn't have an orchestra book. So their music director sent me a CD of their show. There were 23 tunes in there, and I had 9 weeks to do 23 tunes. So the thing about that show is you don't really get to put your stamp of your signature on these things. It's kind of like when I wrote some charts for Alan Toussaint. I knew that he didn't want you to mess with his music. So, for example, if he plays in his tune, if he plays a D minor chord, you don't get to add anything else. He doesn't want a D minor 7 or a D minor 9. And he came up to me after the rehearsal and he said, thank you for not adding anything to my music.
Okay.
So that's what I did for the Beach Boys. The first thing I did was I just transcribed their parts so that the score matched the CD that they sent me. and I put in the melody and I put in the words and I put in the bass line. And then I just, it's sort of like a crossword puzzle. You get the crossword puzzle built with those basic things. Then I would just go through and say, okay, this section needs some string pads, or this section needs some woodwind flourishes. So that's how that happened.
Okay. Well, I was there for that, and that was an amazing performance. So you did good.
I don't know if you remember the music director for the Beach Boys. I can't remember his name, but he was a bass player.
Okay.
And he said, "Man, I have never conducted an orchestra." I said, "I'll trade you." So on that Blues in G flat, Barbara Ann, mm-hmm. one of the dumbest tunes in the world, I played bass. And he conducted the orchestra, which tells you a little bit about how important a conductor is.
Yeah.
All you got to do is get the band started, and they're not going to watch you. So, sorry, maestro, but
we won't tell him. So you also mentioned in a prior interview that you got to conduct the Boston Symphony at Tanglewood.
Yes.
Back in 2008.
That was very. Strange, because I got called a week before the gig by Terrence Blanchard's road manager, and he said, "Hey, Terrence is doing a concert at Tanglewood, and we need a conductor." They didn't tell us they didn't have a conductor for that gig. "Are you available?" I said, "Yeah, okay." So they shipped me the music, and it was a piece that he had written called Requiem for Katrina.
Mm.
And it was the film score he had done for Spike Lee, a movie called When the Levees Broke. And it's for orchestra and jazz quintet. And as you might expect, this piece is dark.
Yeah.
It's morose. It's powerful. So I studied the score. And Saturday morning before the gig, it was 2008, early August, and Gustav was brewing in the Gulf. So we get on a plane, and we fly to Tanglewood, do the rehearsal, and get ready to do the concert in Seijo Zawa Hall, which is just amazing. And everything's going really well. And I got the word right before I walked out that I was conducting a piece about Katrina. At the same time, Gustav was bearing down on Baton Rouge. And if you remember, Baton Rouge got torn up much worse than we did in Katrina.
Yeah.
So it was exciting, but it was also very emotional. Because
a little too much deja vu there, huh?
All over again.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. So it's never easy to retire. So what made you say, okay, I've had enough of this, I'm hanging it up?
Let me think. My wife has Parkinson's. I don't think she'd mind me saying that. And while she does really, really well coping with that, I need to be there more than I need to be at LSU. I had been teaching young students for 34 years. Wow. Don't play a C sharp on a D7 chord, that's not a good note, or play that note long, play that note short. And the other problem was, the university, I had done 10 years of administration over there, and I began to see it as, instead of a great institution of higher education, I began to look at it, whether it is or not, the way I viewed it was, it's just one more state agency. Most of my colleagues, I think, would say, "Hey, I'll teach for free, but you got to pay me a lot to go to committees, fill out forms, write lesson plans, syllabus, all that stuff."
Yeah, drowning in paperwork.
Drowning in paperwork. And the students were different. I guess what really did it was I realized that the skills I could offer my students were no longer relevant to them, or they weren't interested or something. I miss my friends over there, but I don't miss the teaching.
Okay.
Teaching jazz history to 500 students with no teaching assistant.
No, thank you.
No.
So what do you do now besides from playing duets with your wife? And
well, I have this new hobby. It's called medication.
take a pill.
Well, Jan and I go to, she has physical therapy 2 days a week for her walking, and she has strength training 2 days a week. And listen, she's pretty strong. They've actually put her on video on their website to motivate other physical training people. They say, look, here's a woman in her 60s with Parkinson's, and she's doing better than you are. What's wrong?
Yeah. Okay.
So we do that every day. What else do I do?
Do you do some woodworking? Did I read somewhere that you do?
Yeah, I used to do more than I do now. I've done a lot of repair work for friends in our neighborhood. And when we moved, I lost a great shop, but I'm slowly putting a new one together. Right now, I'm writing a couple of shows. Both of them for Father Greg Daigle.
Okay.
One of them is an orchestra show that we do in Plaquemine at his church every January. It's a combination of sacred Broadway Sinatra type music,
okay.
And we hire 27 orchestra musicians.
Oh, wow.
And it's always a hit. And then we're working on a cabaret show for a small group that we'll do at the Arts Council in the Black Box Theater. And I think we're going to call it An Evening with Greg Daigle, Songs I Can't Sing in Church.
I love it.
For example, I don't know if you know who Tom Lehrer is. He still is alive. He was a singer back in the 1960s, and he wrote some outrageously satirical and humorous tunes. One is called Poisoning Pigeons in the Park. Another one is about the atomic bomb, and it's called Who's Next? Who's going to get the bomb next? Very funny. So we're going to do some of those, and then he's going to sing some ballads. He's going to sing tunes that might not have lyrics that are appropriate for church.
Okay. No clutching of the pearls.
No.
Okay, remind us one more time. The 70th birthday celebration is when?
March the 27th.
March 27th.
Here. And it will be at the Arts Council, and it's at 7:30. And I'm sure there's a website there where they can get those.
And that is artsbr.org, artsbr.org. Thanks for joining us.
We'll see
you next week. We thank you for joining us this morning for AC23. You can catch replays on Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Support for this programming comes from Shell, our generous donors and members. To help us continue programming like this, please consider joining the Arts Council or becoming a donor. Information can be found on our website, artsbr.org. That's artsbr.org.